Welcome back to Live at the Backyard Comedy Club podcast. We have a wonderful episode for you with a conversation with the brilliant comedian Carl Donnelly. I've known Carl for over a decade. He's a very, very funny man, an incredible creative mind of taking comedy into different genres of not just joke telling. And Chris, did you enjoy?
I had a great time. We got to talk about movies this time.
We did talk about movies a lot.
We talked about movies and TV.
Yeah.
Finally, the ball's in my court now.
I don't want to know where your balls are.
I knew if I just mentioned ball. Tits? Question mark?
Your balls are in a court?
Someone's courting my balls.
Somebody's courting them. Yeah. Why are they doing that?
Have you seen them?
No.
When you put them in a pretty dress and do their hair.
Have you seen a video on Vimeo of my balls?
I haven't seen it directly on Vimeo. I've seen it on the saved video that's on your phone. And for a man who loses so many phones, you somehow put it back on instantly to the new phone.
It's because it's on Vimeo. I'm showing it off Vimeo.
Oh, right. You're doing direct. And then you show me again. It's where can the listeners? I'll put a link to it on the podcast actually for the listeners. There we go. A little bit of, let's get interactive, shall we? If he's going to make these ridiculous.
While we're talking about being interactive with the listeners, please do sort of send us a tweet or review us on iTunes. Our numbers seem to be pretty bloody impressive, but we've not heard a lot from you guys. So send us what you'd like us to ask a comedian or call us some names. Just let us know that you're there.
Bit beggy.
Isn't it? We know you're there. We know you're there.
Come out. Come out now. Summer's here. Come out from inside. It's over. That's all it is.
So send us a tweet or don't. Or review us or don't. Those are your options.
Yeah. Or send money. That's another option too. P.O. Box people at London.
I hope you enjoy the conversation. Chris? Release the terabytes.
There's something about being aware of
how much you move.
Yeah, little things like that. Even like your heart rate. It's quite interesting now about your heart rate. It's like, mine fluctuates from like, if I'm exercising, I'm quite a calm person anyway. My resting heart rate just goes zoom down to like, I got it down to 59, my resting heart rate regularly, like over the course of about a week, which is like, you know, they reckon sort of anywhere between 60 and 80 is good. So if you're at that end of it, you're really good. Some athletes get it down to like late 40s.
Really?
But that's like, they're people that are like sort of, you know, long distance runners and stuff. Mm. But yeah, I had it down to 59, but then I stopped doing like exercise for a while.
You do seem like a calm man, Carl.
No, I am now, yeah. I used to be a bit mad and erratic and stuff.
What do you think you did to change things?
I changed loads of stuff. Things like, you know, I took out a lot of the things that were causing anxiety. Oh. Simplified my life, got into meditation, went vegan. I did loads of things that I think just simplified my existence down to like the basics.
Becoming a vegan doesn't seem to simplify things because it's quite
so
complicated.
Simple. No,
because you only eat carrots.
Well, it's not. You're not adding anything, are you? You're taking things out of your. You're simplifying your life by taking things out. That's what simplification of life is.
Is it the meditation that you do? Do you have a mantra? Did you have to?
No, I just do all sorts. And I'm not somebody who thinks. Well, I know some people that like, do like an hour a day, and I just do it when I fancy it. Like some days I won't do it. Some days I'll do it on a tube. You know what I mean? I'll just put headphones on and put a bit of meditation music on, and just bang.
Do you use a Headspace app?
No, I don't. I don't do sort of guided meditation.
Oh, right.
I popped, weirdly. We're in the Backyard Comedy Club. I sometimes pop like to the London Buddhist Centre just around the corner to the drop-in class at 1 o'clock. If I fancy a bit of guided, I'll go there.
I've been there a couple of times. Yeah,
it's nice, isn't it?
It is nice. A lot of pillows. A lot of pillows. That's what I couldn't get used to, is the comfortable position.
That thing about sitting, you know. I think it's quite actually. I'm not very good at the sort of sit upright for an hour. You know, that's the proper way to sort of do it if you want to you know, really get somewhere with it. But I just do it.
It gets the same effect, right?
Yeah, but it's meant to be they reckon in terms of proper meditation, you're meant to be sat a certain way. You're meant to sort of be active as well as, you know, so there's a certain amount of activity to it.
Right, so it's different to sleep that you are holding that's the danger. Your own weight.
It's not just relaxing. It's an action meditation, isn't it? You're doing something. You're not just not doing something.
That's the new genre.
Yeah.
Action meditation.
Active meditation.
Action meditation.
Classes.
Yeah.
It's like yoga, isn't it? Yoga, I think, actually is like meditation, but it's actually an exercise.
As yeah.
Well. So if you do, I went through a phase of doing it quite a lot and loved it, but I loved it because it felt, my head felt like I'd done an hour of meditation.
Right.
My body felt like I'd done an hour of
exercise. I felt, I go in and out of being really into yoga, and it tends to be the type of class is so different between some that is good and you do come out feeling flushed out, just, you know, mental toxins have been flushed out and you feel like you've done a bit of exercise.
Yeah.
Or you just feel somebody's wasted your time for an hour and a half.
Or I don't like the ones where it's too exercisey. I went to a hot yoga class in Birmingham.
Oh, yeah, I've done a couple of
those. And two issues I had with it. One, it was so full on, like, it just felt unpleasant. At no point did I feel relaxed, which I think yoga should have. Right. Second point, and this is going to sound a bit harsh, the instructor was quite a big guy, like in terms of weight-wise, and not big in a sort of muscular way. And he wasn't doing any of the moves. He was just telling us to do them.
Was it a Bikram one?
It wasn't Bikram. I think because there's different, a lot of them don't call it Bikram anymore. Yeah, because it got done for sexual
assault. Oh, really? Something amazing, I say amazing. A large amount, shocking is probably the better verb than amazing. Yeah. It's like 38 cases of sexual assault.
But didn't he, and he did that creepy thing that all, not all, but like, it's quite common in the sort of, me and Chris Martin discussed this once on our podcast about gurus. There's nothing creepier than a guru, like, they're always up to something. Not all of them, some of them I'm sure have good reasons, but a lot of them definitely abuse their power. And I think Bikram guy did that.
Mm. There's some serious cult leader vibes with them, isn't there? Whether it's the cult leaders deciding to wear robes in that fashion post the guru.
Yeah.
Or which one fed the other.
Oh yeah, it could be a power thing, isn't it? Once you get to that point of being a guru and people are elevating you to that position.
I have no need for pants.
Do you feel all this meditation and changes has changed your comedy?
I don't know. Maybe, yeah. In terms of, I don't think it's changed physically what I do on stage, but I think
how you start on a bit or what?
Sometimes I think I'm just. No, I don't. Do you know what? I don't actually think it does. I think it's changed my intentions of comedy a lot. Like, I'm much more carefree now about what I do, where and why I'm doing it, and. You know, I'm not. I was never somebody who looked at other people and was like, "Why aren't I doing that?" or "Why aren't I doing that?" But there was still little. You know, you can't help but have a little bit of you as a comic who sees other people, mates, like doing certain things, and you're not thinking, "Why aren't I doing that?" Angrily, I'd always be like, "Oh, it'd be nice to do that." And now I've almost gone too far the other ways in that I genuinely have almost zero ambition above doing. But every gig is the next. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking about, the next thing.
I think that's a great place to be.
It is, but it's also not. My agent doesn't agree. You know, no, because I think they always. You know, I think people always assume you should have a bigger idea, shouldn't you? You should be like, I'm aiming to do this, so that leads to that, and that will get that. I think it's that seeing it as a career rather than. And I really struggle now to ever think beyond. I just want to write my next funny thing. So I think it's sent me a bit too far into like the hippie, it's all about just living in the moment.
You become zen.
Well, yeah, which is really nice for your mental health, but it's not great for your, sort of long-term career prospects.
Sure. A zen comic.
I think stand-up is definitely a thing that you do have to be in the moment.
Yeah, you do. But I do think that the people that go very, you know, in terms, depends what you view success as, but the people that take it to sort of a big level of financially and things like that, I definitely think, all the ones I know. Yeah, not business plans, but they all definitely do have that mindset of, you know, I'd like to do this to way more people.
And, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't think that's not a bad thing. I'm not criticising them. I just don't have that.
I used to be in a cooperative management thing where you go in and you do like 3 days a month in the office, and right. when you're there, you're everybody else's agent. And when it was a lovely thing to do.
That idea.
It was great. I can't recommend it enough. But there was this thing when people auditioned to be, and they'd say, oh, what type of work do you want to do? They'd yeah. always just go, I just want to work. I just want to act.
Yeah,
and I think over the years of how many different actors and stand-ups, I know the ones that have gone on didn't say that. Like Tom Hardy never said, "I just want to act."
No,
he said, "I want to be
a star,
king."
Yeah, totally. somebody was telling me some stories about him yesterday. That I can't confirm they're true, so I won't
please,
tell them. But
we can put at the front that this is a speculative.
Well, no, it's allegedly he's very difficult to work with. Mm. There's examples of him being very, like, sort of bad to crew members and stuff, which I don't know. Again, it could be total bullshit.
Yeah,
somebody just told me yesterday, and but I suppose it's, I think we were talking about because that thing of him, he does strike me as somebody who takes it very seriously and very intense and fucking, you know, you wouldn't want to. It's that Christian Bale thing, isn't it? You don't want to walk across his eye line.
Yeah, it's that thing as well where you know people fawn over that, like, he's amazing and he is very good at things on screen.
He's very good at one style of acting.
Yeah, one style of acting.
Come on, mate, let's not kid ourselves.
He's very good at Tom Hardy.
He's not Philip Seymour.
But then people always like, I'd love to be with him or hang out. But they don't think about the reality. It's like, well, to be like that, you know, it's the Johnny Depp approach, I say. It's like, you might want to go out with him now, but you won't enjoy him when he's licking your cat's arsehole. Yeah. Now look at him, he's all out there, we know what he's really like.
Did you see the photo of him last week?
Where he looks very ill. He's got a very Philadelphia look to him.
Yeah, he has. And this is the thing, I saw an article in, I think it's the Daily Mail, and
it's like cream cheese.
And it just said, does he look rough because he's not wearing his makeup? That's what they say. Because then they put the photo of him looking like he's about to die,
yeah,
next to a photo of just the normal him when he's got like his eyeliner and all his jewelry and that. And it's like, no, he still looks about 4 stone. Like, he's, like, it's such a weird like article of them trying to.
They're trying to grab onto anything that makes it different from the rest.
And it wasn't. He looks genuinely ill.
Yeah. He's been touring around with a band, hasn't he? It's like him, Alice Cooper, and someone else they've got.
Yeah. He is also a raging alcoholic
and druggy.
Let's not look down on those people.
No, I'm not looking down at him. I'm just saying, I'm surprised he's managed to function for this long without crumbling. You know what I mean? It's not like he's ever had a period of bloody.
He's probably on a bender post everything that's happened of recent. Mm. Wouldn't be surprised. Nothing to curb him anymore.
No.
Do you still drink?
I do. Yeah.
So,
I still love a bit of it now and again. But I just now, I just don't drink all that. I don't do that thing I used to do, which is drink at all gigs.
Right, yeah.
I used to do that thing of every gig I get to, I'll have a
first
beer.
Thing, yeah.
I'll have a beer after. And like, just over a week, that is just loads of booze.
Yeah. Mm. And you can have 4 pints at a gig without psychologically even think that you're drinking.
Absolutely. And then by the end of the week, that's, 20 pints or something, which is horrendous, really.
Because you arrive, because in most clubs you're asked if you want to drink when you arrive. And you have one before you go on, take one on stage with you, and have one after the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And then somebody goes, do you want to drink? Oh, I don't think I'm drinking tonight. I've already had 3 pints of beer.
One of the biggest curses is that it's free as well, right?
I actually think, so there's quite a few clubs now that no longer provide the booze they used to. Comedy Store that fridge used to be stocked with beer. And then a few comics took the piss for too long. When I say a few, I mean Mike Wilmot. And now it's no longer. You just said there's a limited amount of alcohol.
But there isn't as many people drinking.
No, it's died off.
There's a gig in Reading, a lovely little gig in a bar called Milk. And it's kind of like they just pay your expenses, but it's a completely free bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I arrived, somebody said, where did you park? And I went, I'm not driving to this gig. I'm being paid in alcohol, idiot. And they went, oh, God, it's been ages since a comic's taken up us up on the offer.
Really?
And I said, what, has it stopped? And I went, no.
Just no one does
nobody
it.
Does it.
It's, it definitely has died off. Mm. You know, I feel like I just caught the end of my generation of comics. I think were the last ones that had a little heyday of going mad.
So when did you start? Because you were quite... You were already getting paid work and were sort of quite established as a when I started.
When did you start?
2007.
Yeah, so 2007, I was. That was the year I went full-time. But when I say full-time, it was hard, that was hard work. I mean, I'd been going for like 2.5 years. So it's early 2005 was when I properly started. And then like I sort of, by 2007, I was getting enough paid gigs that I could just about cover my bills and then eat nothing almost. Like, so I did that. But yeah, but then, so a lot of that sort of 2006 to 2010 period, that the where sort of a lot of my mates, my mates have now started, there were still a lot of people starting that were quite sort of, you know, laddie, and not in a negative way. I mean, like this, like me, you know, we were all coming from like similar backgrounds, and people like Paul McCaffrey and Matt Ford and Sean Walsh and, you know, Chris Martin, people like, we were all just like sort of young blokes.
Yeah.
Or not young, but not even that young, but just, there was still that thing of get to Edinburgh and get pissed for a month.
Yeah.
And it was fun. It was really exciting. I don't, you know.
Remember that.
But then fun. I think it just, I do think the generations after that have realised it's a much harder industry now to break into. You've got to be a bit more professional. And you shouldn't be seen crawling out of the loft bar at
5 o'clock
every morning, 5 a.m. Or you shouldn't be seen, you know, three of you coming out of the disabled toilets every night in, you know, the library bar and stuff. So I think, I actually think for the better, probably the industry is cleaned up.
Do you think they look at it differently now? Do you think they look at people like that and go, oh, we don't want them because they have that lifestyle?
With the
industry, I suppose.
No, not really, because the industry is still the one coming out of the toilet cubicles in threes.
Yeah, exactly. I've been to Edinburgh. They're the worst for it.
Let's be honest, TV producers are not known for their clean living.
Yeah.
But no, I don't think they do. But I just think it's just, it's now, you know, such a competitive industry and landscape that I think younger comics starting out know that they need to just be firing on all cylinders to just get a chance. Because it's not, you know, there's, for any single gig now, there's probably 2,000 people trying to get it.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think, I think what I mean is timing wise, I think I luckily caught the end of it being a bit easier to.
How old were you when you started?
23.
It's quite young.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was young. This is a conversation I had yesterday. It was a couple of newer acts who we got a train back from where in Hertfordshire together. And it was that thing. I didn't realise that 23 was quite young. Because I think when I started as well, there was a few people like Kevin Bridges and Russell Howard who were already doing really well when they were younger than me.
Yeah.
Oh no, Russell was the same age as me, but Kev was like a couple of years younger.
But now I don't think it's young at all. People are all starting at university. We're doing heats of So You Think You're Funny here at the moment. And there are loads of people that technically probably shouldn't be in the bar.
Yeah.
Or on stage.
Well, that happens. The level of competence is so much higher than it was when I started. Yeah.
Because I spoke to somebody who said, this was last year, said, I think it was So You Think You're Funny last year, and this isn't an indictment on the people that ended up winning or getting to the final, but they said actually across the board, the heats, it was like the lowest calibre they'd seen last year that was. So this year, it might just be every year's different, isn't it? This year might be a good year.
I wouldn't say that the best are any better or worse than, but I just think if I go to an open mic night, there's one that I go to on a Tuesday in Kentish Town, because if I get a new bit I just have to do that night, I'll pop in. And there'll be 10 acts on, and there'll only be one or two mental patients.
Really? I see it. I think the nutters have definitely got less.
There's like basically, there's 10 people with a business plan and 2 mental patients. Whereas back when I started, it would have been 2 people with a business plan and 10 mental patients.
Well, it would have just been two decent people, 5 nutters, and then 3 just sort of people just wanted to give it a go.
Yeah.
And had no designs on ever doing it properly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite nice. Hobbyist, Whereas, definitely, I think now most of them people in that room want to do comedy. Yeah. And they're like, this is our thing.
This is going to be a career.
But it's definitely less nutters. It's really...
It's unfortunate, really.
I loved it. That's one of my things I miss the most is gigging with absolute lunatics.
Jimbo.
Jimbo's great. Didn't he change his name to Tony Bournemouth? I believe he did. So he came back. He reappeared a few years ago. Joel Elnor was another good one. Paolo Ferrari, he was a good nutter.
Paolo Ferrari.
Yeah, there was excellent acts.
What was
Ray Presto?
What was crazy about these people?
I mean, they were just, you know, Paolo Ferrari I did a gig with him once where he just climbed out the window and, yeah. and we were like two floors up and he this just
the Camden Head.
Might have been the, no, it wasn't the Camden Head.
I saw him down there as well.
And he'd just climb around the building, could have died and just like
during the gig.
During his set.
During his set.
Yeah.
So where I saw him doing it, the Camden Head in Angel, not the Camden Head. Camden. Yeah. He was reciting a poem, and he just continued to recite the poem while opening a window, pretending that he was committing suicide, but then just getting to the edge of the wall, then climbing around the wall to another window, coming back into it, and continuing his poem as if it was nothing was happening.
That's incredible, though.
That isn't performance art. I don't know what it is.
If you're not risking your life,
it was so funny though, wasn't it? It was just that thing. It was proper the ends of alternative, the old alternative comedy.
Mm. There was a guy called who's amazingly an air traffic controller in real life, but he'd run these really sort of alternative wacky nights. Dorian Cook, I think his name was, and he's mates with Bob Mortimer and and everything. You know. They didn't want to hear you want to be Bill Hicks. They wanted people to be mental.
Totally.
It was just encouraging.
I remember my second gig. I did it with Joe Roundtree when Joe was doing a character called Sheldon Pellets. That's how he started. He started out as a character coming. And it was the funniest, maddest thing. He came on in a hospital gown, just with his arse out. And he had like a cast on his wrist. And he was just this escaped outpatient, and he was just screaming at the audience, and it was brilliant. That was sort of the normal. You get to the gig, and it'd be some crazy stuff going on.
Do you think there's less demand for that style of comedy at the moment? Like, it's not in vogue currently.
I don't know. I just think people are just it goes with the times, doesn't it? Mm. The late 2000s is when TV comedy kicked off. And by TV, I mean like stand up, standing on the Apollo, doing 10-minute sets that were so slick and. You know, that I think that just caused a whole wave of comedy that was like that. Because everyone just, it always leads the way, doesn't it? And then I think now it's all changing again. I think
What would you say it's going to now? Have you seen like the early days of anything new?
Well, the last few years, it's just definitely got more alternative. People like Sam Simmons and,
I love Sam Simmons.
John Kearns, Jordan Brooks, people like Holly Byrne, and suddenly all just wait. There's loads of people now that are just back to like alternative.
I've noticed that the alternative scene seems to be because it's fresh, isn't it? It feels fresh again. We've missed it for a long time, and everyone's a bit bored of what we're seeing. But that alternative seems to just feels good, doesn't it? See a lot of clowning, clowning stand-ups that whole, I really enjoy at the moment.
There was that period of did you see Zoe Coombs Mars show in Edinburgh a couple of years ago? No. It got nominated. It's brilliant, but it was sort of a piss take, a bit of clowning, but it was very fun. It was very so it did become a thing where every other act seemed to be going off to Goulière in Paris. And
I've only recently discovered just how many people went to this well-known world-renowned clown school. I didn't know clown school was always a joke to me growing up. It was something that Homer did, but then now I'm like, there's these people who have a business plan and a red nose, and they actually have red noses they leave with, and it's legitimate. My girlfriend did go to Goulière, and I will make fun of it till the end of time.
it's that thing where I really like, I love a lot of the acts that have done it.
Oh, don't worry, you don't have to. I'm not.
I think it's something very. But for every one good person that comes out, there's going to be 10 lemons. Yeah. But I think there's something to be said for that, out of your comfort zone.
I've recently been watching a lot of their comedy from that scene. They all went to Goulière, all these people. And there's some great stuff. It's just so fresh. It is a nice change.
It's fearless,
change.
Isn't it? That's what it teaches fearless. You.
And there's so much of this terrified newbie comedy that I'm seeing, where it's all very soft and it's not entertaining to me anymore. So I needed something to revitalize my love for stand-up, other than the old school where the old school where I don't give a fuck about anything.
I find a lot of sort of the old school as well. There was definitely, when you do a lot of big weekend clubs, I get frustrated with the amount of comics that shit themselves and do their old classic stuff from 10 years ago.
Yeah,
And I think there's something to be said for that middle ground, like taking some inspiration from them Goulière types to just commit to, on the nights, be funny. Don't worry about oh, if I don't do my best stuff, I won't get booked again. Just actually just play that gig how you should play it, I think.
Yeah.
So that's what I get frustrated with. I always try and do new stuff. Like anytime I'm at the Comedy Store, I always try and do a different set sort of last time I was there. Just even if I was only there 3 months before, just because I think this is meant to be the home of alternative comedy, so yeah. I want to play it like that. Mm. I don't want to just shit myself thinking, oh, it's Donning, and then go on and do my fucking 20 from 5 years ago.
Also, I mean, I know Don has this thing about doing your best thing and they don't want, but equally, he doesn't want to see the same thing twice. He's a human being.
He doesn't give a shit. If he watches you smash that gig, doesn't matter if you've done new stuff or old stuff, that's all he wants. He just wants to see people be funny. Obviously, if you go on and do 20 minutes of new stuff and tank, then that's the issue. But then, you know, I'm not saying I wouldn't do brand new stuff I've never said before. Although I have done a few times, but I've done a couple of cheeky bits of new.
I think you kind of have to do a new bit when it comes to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't wait for a safe gig because that joke will go off.
Absolutely. I think I'd rather die on stage than have one of them gigs. The gigs I get most annoyed driving home from a gig, just miserable, is where I just shit myself and it was a bit rubbish and I just sort of did it all on their terms and did some stuff I haven't done for ages. And they're the ones I find more frustrating than if I went on and just tried something new and it stank.
Sure. Well, somebody said to me, I think it was maybe Dave Ward of this club, said when it was very early doors, he said, if somebody told you that there was £100 in an envelope on a bar in Exeter, you would not drive down there to get it. But you get somebody tells you there's a gig in Exeter for £100, you're in your car in a heartbeat. So we're not doing this for the money. We're not doing it for we're doing it because we like doing it. So when you get into your car after there's a string of corporate gigs. Well, they're not corporates, as in not the phenomenally well-paid, glamorous corporates, but they're corporate in feel. That are in sort of function rooms of hotels. I'm sure you probably know which promoter I'm talking about. And I'd regularly after them. You know, I'd done my best for that night, but there was such a sort of sanitized corporate air that you really couldn't do anything other than just sort of like hit your marks and try and put on a professional show. And you get into your car afterwards and just go,
It's funny, that's the thing, but there's an inverted snobbery, I think, from a lot of acts who get stuck in that sort of scene about, you know, you often hear, especially this is getting into the period now, 2 months before Edinburgh, where a lot of dressing rooms, there'll be an old fucking bald bloke saying to you, what, you're not doing Edinburgh, are you? Like, that's sort of like weird. Oh, what you go up there for? Just waste thousands of pounds. It's like, and part of you is thinking, because I don't want to end up like you, mate. Like, sitting in dressing rooms moaning about Edinburgh. Like,
sure.
For somebody who doesn't care for it, you don't have to talk about it. And I was like, that was not referring to anyone in particular. It's just like, I find myself, there's a lot of, and that's not even old people. I mean, there's people of my generation. There's people below, like people who started out after me, and I've had that conversation with, like, oh, I'm not never doing Edinburgh again. And it's like, and they just talk about it in such a weird, why would I go up there and just bloody, you know, be ignored or whatever. And it's like, well, part of it is the challenge of doing Edinburgh. It's exciting, isn't it? It's the challenge of writing a new hour and little things like that, I think, keep the excitement that you used to have for, when you were new, for open spots. Doing a new hour is now, once you're established. That, Edinburgh for me feels like doing like, you know, bloody The Laughing Horse, new act of the year in 2006.
It's a nice outlook. It's like it's a training camp that you have to do for a month because it takes all this energy and fortitude.
Well, you need challenges because every, you know, once you're on a circuit and you're established, you know what, every gig you're playing you've done before. So there's no challenge to it, is there? The challenge is just obviously going and having a good gig, but that's just a constant, isn't it? Whereas you need to add a few hurdles throughout the year to keep it exciting and entertaining, I think.
So I take it you're going to Edinburgh this year?
Yeah, I've never had a year off.
Really?
Yeah, since 2006 when I did a three-hander in 2006. Then I did the Comedy Zone 2007, doubleheader with John Robbins 2008, and I've been doing solo shows.
Wow.
This is my 10th solo show in a row.
Solid hour.
That's amazing. So where are you waiting?
I'm doing the Counting House Ballroom. I'm doing three for the first time. So that is going to... I'm going to be interested to see what that's like.
And what drove that decision to go from a paid venue to a free venue?
Last year, I just had so much fun, and also I definitely had... There's something about taking off the financial pressure of Edinburgh. You know, I never really think about the money. But in when you're doing obviously a paid venue and you spend a lot of money on promotion, and you know there's a lot invested financially as well as mentally and creatively and all that. When you go out on stage and like you know in a big venue and there's a lot of money on the line,
yeah.
every empty seat you see, you're is paying for.
It? Yeah.
And genuinely, there was nights where you'd have a quiet one, a Wednesday night, it would just be a bit quiet, and you'd walk out on stage and see that, and it would actually, I think, get in your head. So during the show, there'd be a little bit of a no, and that's not a good thing to have in your head when you're doing a show. So having done the bus last year just as a total like little silly bit of fun, this year I thought actually I might see what it's like to do it without that financial burden. Gamble. Yeah, it's still spending money. You yeah, know? You're spending loads. Well,
spending a month to be up month there. In a different city. Yeah, renting a flat.
Yeah, still you know, flat in London. If you rent, I pay rent, so my rent in London's still there. Like your cost, you double your cost of living for a month. Yeah.
Mm.
Extortionate amounts for a flat. You've got to pay for flyers. Mm. There's shitloads of outlays. So you're still spending money, but to then know that every bit of money that comes back in comes straight to me.
Yeah,
I think will be quite nice. Mm. And I'm not going to do that hard sell that some people on the Free Fringe do of like.
Yeah,
guys. You know, some shows cost you £20, so why don't you put 25 in mine? You know, that thing of really pushing the bucket speech.
Yeah.
I want this to be quite a stress-free month, so I'm just going to explain that you know it's free. But if they could put something in, that would be nice. And also, I'm happy with whatever they put in, and if they really can't afford it, that's cool. Isn't it?
Yeah.
If this was the only way they could see a show, I'm quite happy that they'd do that.
Mm.
It's a good way to do it, I think. I saw a couple of. I went up last year just as trying to fall back in love with it because I did it a few years on the bounce and got a bit disillusioned by it.
Yeah.
And so just went up. I didn't take any gigs while I was up there. Just wanted to like see like five shows a day. Yeah. And I saw some cracking fringe shows, free fringe shows. They were kind of ruined by 7 minutes of begging at the end.
It is that thing. Me and Paul Tomkinson were talking about this last week. But it would be funny to do a 1 hour bucket speech. Like, put a show in and just call it something.
Bucket
very, speech. Yeah, you could call it that. But I think call it something vague that doesn't suggest what you're doing. And to start the show and going, guys, welcome, this is the Free Fringe. You start explaining what the Free Fringe is, and just for a whole hour, you don't actually do the show.
Mm.
But you just constantly talk about the bucket and the finances, and it'd be hilarious.
Yeah, it
would be. It's due, because it's become a very common thing now, the Free Fringe.
Yeah.
And I think it's due a piss take.
You should just talk for an hour about like problems in your life and why things and like what they're driven by, and all of it should be about money. And then just the end, just be like, and that so if you could just please, for God's sake, put so some money in my shit life.
Yeah, that'd be really funny. But I think, I don't want to do
If you haven't got any cash on, your watch will do. Or if you're not wearing your watch, your smartphone. I know.
Anything will do at this point. I've just talked to him for an hour about how shit my life is. That would be great.
I think I would feel awkward doing the long, you know.
Right.
Put £10 in, put £20 in, put that sort of.
Yeah, you want to leave people feeling great about what they've just seen, and that's why you know you come out running, and then you leave them on a high.
Yeah. Well, weirdly, I've got an idea for the end of the show that I can sort of sneak the bucket speech very brief, like literally a 10-second thing, in which, but because I'm thinking of ending on a song, which sounds worse than it is, but it refers to a routine I've got that's in this new show about modern buskers. And I think it might be funny to then.
Modern buskers have.
Well, no, just like about. They seem just that sort of brand of modern sort of hipster buskers. Got a beard and they're just obsessed with nostalgia. They're always doing like cover versions, a weird sort of rearranged versions of 90s pop songs. And, you know, I'd say it's just about that weird, you know. I don't want to ever go at hipsters. It's more about that obsession with the past that runs through hipster culture.
Social media job by day, busker by night.
Well, yeah, just that obsession with nostalgia.
Well, isn't the whole hipster movement, isn't it driven by the fact that in this technological age where, you know, there seems to be less class or less craft to a lot of things. So this sort of want to wear tweed and go around on a penny farthing is
something real, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Old real shit.
It's not everything existing through a Twitter account. Yeah. There's a lust to have a watch that you can see the working parts on it or something, yeah. Right?
It's too much now, though. I have a friend who has a tendency to do ridiculous things. And I think nostalgia's now got, we're too far into the technological age, because it's like, oh, I bought something, an amazing piece of retro kit the other day, mate. Yeah, yeah, what'd you buy? A Sony CD Walkman.
Yeah, yeah.
CD, yeah, tape, I would kind of understand, but when you're going to CD, they were shit.
Yeah, yeah.
They were really
cumbersome
shit.
Cumbersome and that's, shit.
Yeah. That's just bad technology.
Yeah.
Bad technology.
Mini-disc.
Go mini-disc if you're going to get anything.
That's a nice bit of kit.
Yeah, oh, then mini-disc never had the life it should have, that it deserved. Did it?
They were lovely looking as well.
Mm. They were made of metal. There was a sort of steel. Mm. They looked like they were they were made to be taken into a war zone.
Yeah.
Touch screens aren't for war zones.
No.
Because you can't wear your gloves. that's the reason. That's how they take us down. That's really the weapon of mass destruction that we create next. Something that stops you being able to touch screens. We're fucked. We're all fucked.
I recently I've seen some self-taped auditions, and I've been doing them on my smartphone, but I lost my Google Pixel, which has a phenomenal camera on it, and I booted up an old phone, which doesn't have it. So I got out of a drawer an old camcorder, digital one, not one with cassettes or something. And it's actually a very good camera, so I've like set it up now as a permanent thing that is ready to go, which does make my bedroom look a little bit like I'm always ready to make a sale for sex tape.
How does that go down?
Don't mind
tape, apparently.
Don't mind circuit 8 in the corner. but when I rebooted it up, because I hadn't used it for a few years, I bought it like, I think 2012, from my 2012 Edinburgh show. I wanted to film and learn off my previews, and I bought it for that. So I hadn't really used it since then. And I literally was there for a good 5 minutes poking the screen, going, why isn't it responding?
Yeah.
And then realised, oh, it's not a touchscreen.
Mad, isn't it? In that 5 years, that what, 6 years?
Yeah.
It's mad.
I read something recently about someone's toddler was given a magazine, and they were going, had it open, and they were trying to swipe the pages.
Oh, God.
And we forget how that will be a film that we make, where it's someone will put that in a film in the future, and then people are like, what are these ancient things? They don't swipe. In like a bad Disney retro-futurism film.
Demolition Man. I watched Demolition Man every week, and it's got loads of moments where...
An incredible movie.
I've never seen it. What?
No. You don't know about the three shells? He doesn't know about three shells.
You mean you've got to watch it for yourself. Yeah. It's, there's loads of moments in that where you can sort of see our future happening. Yeah. I love
how it starts with that idea that LA, because it was at that time as well, it was quite a shithole.
And it becomes
a proper war zone.
Like dystopian.
Great movie.
I should check it out.
Great character names.
It's a real caveman movie.
Oh, yeah. It's,
I'm not quite sure what you're implying by that.
No, like total You're a caveman. You're an unevolved.
As a Neanderthal, you are going to really enjoy this.
His name's John Spartan in it. That's the character.
That was my name.
This is Wesley Snipes.
Simon Phoenix.
The greatest villain of all time.
He's great in it. He's really good.
It's a great movie.
It's
up there with Total Recall. Probably better, actually. I think I prefer it to those films in a slightly different way, but it's got that very, action. It's the last of the great action movies, I think.
Well, it's in that, there was that period, sort of, it was when it was coming to an end. Early 90s is when the action film sort of died, didn't it?
Yeah, where everything had a theme song by some randomer that was unrelated to the movie in the 90s.
It was when films suddenly had to mean something. That's what the 90s sort of did, isn't it?
Everybody thinks of 94 being this sort of like year of independent filmmaking, because it was the year of Pulp Fiction.
Oh, and Pulp Fiction, yeah.
And everything that sort of like it seemed to be a sort of... definitely. I mean, I feel this... year's Oscar class was incredibly interesting, because in this time that our cinemas are so full with Marvel movies, to have movies like Lady Bird and Phantom Thread, I think a film about sewing.
And it
just felt like there definitely is this as popular and as mass money making as the colouring in movies are, there is a desire out there for something about something other.
Totally. That doesn't have to have been. It'd be one in 30 of the same film.
Yeah.
I've totally tapped out of all them.
Yeah,
right?
Me too.
I'll now watch them on Netflix.
Yeah.
I've got no interest in
watching them on my phone while having a shit.
Marvel film. Or Deadpool. Deadpool was the one that almost tipped me over the edge. The first Deadpool film, loads of comedians in dressing rooms are going to be seeing Deadpool. It was so funny. And I watched it and I thought it was so bad. Like, it felt like it was... You could almost hear the writers high-fiving after every fucking line.
I really enjoyed when Nat just said that. I mean, you ruined that film for me. Shit.
Just every time, even the credit every line, just imagine the writer's room. Oh, God.
No.
Because there was a writing team. Just that sort of stuff. I like a film that's, you know... I don't want more than two writers on anything. I think that's...
Chris here is a screenwriter by trade, so that I think he would agree with you. You don't want a committee on something.
I'm a bit funny about working with a second writer, and even then I like to just go, okay, let's talk through the ideas. Okay, I'm going to go away and write this down. I don't mind doing
nice
that.
I think it's just... The world of one person is...
It keeps it succinct. And I think I think it's good to have input and ideas from people, but... Having a single... If you're having two writers, you have to be very much in sync with each other's writing style, which I have not come across someone is that succinct with me.
There's an amazing DVD extra on Cabin in the Woods. Have you seen that?
I love Cabin in
it's
the Woods.
It's great film. And there's a lovely DVD extra when those were a thing about how they wrote it, these two guys. They got a hotel room, and they said one of us wrote in one room, one of us wrote in the other, and when we'd finished a scene, we passed it to the other person. And they passed what they'd been working on, and we reworked it, and we just kept on passing it between each other, and literally by the end of a long weekend, they had Cabin in the Woods.
That's really good. Yeah. There's a thing in LA at the moment, it's been big for a few years, is where there's writing teams have therapy, like couples therapy.
Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah.
Sounds horrific.
Especially ones that have been going for a long time. Yeah, that's why I'm unsure about having a purely writing partner at any point.
Oh, it's just tedious, isn't it?
There's a worry that if something creatively goes through too many filters as well, that you just take all the rough edges off it and therefore all the character.
Also, there's just too many characters in films now. Like, that's the thing with that Marvel. Because they're trying to just cater to everyone.
Yeah, and try to sell as many merchants as possible.
Patience and stuff that the modern age is. Yeah,
that's a trope from the comic books, though. I think it was in the... It might have been before the 80s, during the Silver Age. They realised that if a comic wasn't performing very well or wasn't... might not be very popular or new, that if they put something that was really popular, a crossover with one of those stars come into it, it would get people buying it, and also the loyalists from the other one would have to come and see it.
God.
And now they've put that into film, and you can note it, but that's why it's everywhere. The crossovers are huge. They're doing crossover with 21 Jump Street and Men in Black now.
Oh my God.
You know, it's huge, because they're like, the thing in Hollywood, they've realised, like, well, what if one's not underperforming? We get two huge stars and smash them together. Maybe we'll get a black hole for all our money.
I heard that Mel Gibson, in his sequel to Passion of the Christ, is introducing Jesus to the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, no, he is. Well, he is the greatest superhero of them all. Quick, walk on that water to get away. Oh no, we forgot he's got an average running speed.
Have you seen Dad? It's dreadful. Daddy's Home 2.
No, I haven't. It looks horrendous.
I watched it on a plane. Obviously, that's the only international waters. And Mel Gibson's in it, and he has. I mean, he's definitely forgotten how to act.
Really?
He looks like a crazy man on stage. Everyone else in it can act. Like, Mark Wahlberg does that sort of quite funny Mark Wahlberg thing. Mm. Will Ferrell's naturally funny. And then John Lithgow's in it, who's really...
Yeah, he's a great guy.
A great comic actor, actually. Yeah.
And a brilliant Winston Churchill in The Crown.
I've not seen The Crown.
Yeah, I've only dipped in and out of it, but he is amazing.
Odd Choice was brilliant. Yeah,
but then Gibson. They've chucked Gibson into this one. Oh, and he stinks out every scene he's in.
I don't know if you... But if you think back to Lethal Weapon, you know, he was crazy in that with his pseudo-Australian
sort of accent. Yeah, there was a, I think if you watch... I'm trying to think of... Even films like, you know, Payback and them sorts of the later Lethal Weapons. Like, he can sort of, he can hold his own on screen.
His Hamlet is really good. It's very easy to discount it. But well, it is
back to Mad Max and stuff. Yeah. You know, he was an actor. But he literally, honestly, there's something about him watching this. There's a weirdness to him that is like, there's something odd going on there. It's really uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, it's a strange story, isn't it? There's a devout Catholicism and just general mentalness is.
Yeah.
I've never watched The Passion of the Christ.
You know what? It was actually, it was a very beautiful film at the time.
Well made, yeah.
Yeah, really well made. He's a good director. He makes very nice. I went to see Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah, I've seen that.
But the problem is, it just lacks in story, and you can feel the. Real guts and heart, but it looks great. Very tedious, yeah. And then there's a very strong Christian. This is the problem: his strong Christian messages are so apparent that it's not just focusing on a good story.
Right.
You know, the story of Christ is known as the greatest story ever told. It is your baseline. It is a good story, despite what you believe. It's just a good old story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the morals that he's trying to force on you. And it's
definitely.
The end of Hacksaw Ridge is hilarious.
Yeah,
in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some great moments. But they're doing Passion of the Christ 2. I'm curious as to what that will.
Where does it pick up?
Where do you pick up 3 days later? Cut two.
I just made that up.
He's making a second Passion.
Oh yeah, I did actually hear that. Yeah.
He's back, and this time he's pissed.
Yeah.
This one Rock rolls to the side.
The second double machine gun Jesus.
That's what I always thought about 24, because the first series of 24 is, my name is Jack Bauer, and today is the worst day of my life. Went to 8 series.
Yeah.
My name is Jack Bauer, and this is the 8th worst day of my life.
I've just had a lot of bad days. Yeah. Let's just say my top 10 worst days, they're up there. They're above anything you're going to experience.
At the end of each series, you should have to put it in the league table of where it sits.
I wouldn't mind, but
this one's in at 3.
3 series in, he gets his fingernails pulled off. So I'm like, really? Was the first day number one?
I've never seen an episode of 24.
I'm not.
That's one of my, like, you know, that sort of.
Well, the first season was historically sort of an epoch in television.
Yeah.
But. I thought it was an experiment and a moment. And the second they brought a second series, I tapped out. Never seen a single episode since then.
It's just too big a commitment, isn't it?
No,
I can't. It's too much of There's no point in starting.
There's much better television now. I think it came at a time when that wasn't as big a thing. Yeah. You know, Lost was coming about. They were all amazing because nothing was like that.
Yes.
But now it's all so much better. Except for Sopranos. That is a masterpiece for the rest of time.
I've never finished Sopranos. I'm really bad at finishing. But there's too much stuff.
I've never finished The Wire.
I haven't either. I've only ever watched, not even finished the first season.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm bad.
I love it.
It is this thing you have to
admit. Maybe you should call an Edinburgh show Incompleted box sets.
Incomplete box sets.
So many of them.
Does anybody know what happens at the end of?
Weirdly, Lost is one of the ones I got through. It was only 4 series, and I remember watching the first 3 as they were going out.
I think it was 6, you know.
Isn't it 4?
I think it was 6.
Anyway, it might have been the last series.
I
remember going back, like, when everyone got really annoyed about the last season. I thought, I'm going to watch that one now. I need to know what everyone's so upset about.
You know what? The show does get shit on a lot by a lot of people, but the people who made it, you know, they're all brilliant, you know, creatives, and when it came out, it was incredible. You know,
That first episode.
Yeah, and it's a lot of pressure to keep making that stuff. Yeah, you know, you get demanded. They only intended a short run. And I think the characters they created, I think it was brilliant, and I would still stand by that to today.
Well, it's that thing as well. If you write an amazing pilot and it gets commissioned, and then you write a really good first season, thinking, well, we'll probably only ever get one season, and then suddenly, you know, they say we want you to do 3 more. If you have but he'd written that as a one season thing. It's hard then to drag it out.
Well, apparently that's what happened with the most recent Star Wars. There was no Bible of where the Last Jedi had to take the story for the next film.
Okay.
It was just this is the point that we took it to for The Force Awakens. Yeah. Take it forward. And that's why it's such a fucking hot steaming pile of shit.
It is shit. Weirdly, when I watched it in the cinema, I really liked it. And then I watched it on a plane again, and I thought, yeah, this is crap.
Yeah.
But it's not crap enough to get upset about. That's the thing.
I'm upset.
There was a nice looking moment. It's just, you know what it was is, I've lost, Star Wars has disappointed me so much over the years that I no longer care, which is kind of a sad
point. Well, because you've grown up. It's a kid's film that we're still trying to hold on to as adults.
I can still watch Empire or New Hope. Like, what? Brilliant. Fantastic. You know,
I look at them and find them very dated and think, really? Oh, when I was a kid, these were really good.
Yeah.
I look at them now as kids' films that I can enjoy. Same with like Marvel films.
Yeah.
So the ones that I enjoyed were ones I didn't watch them thinking this is an amazing film. I thought, this is a good kid's film that they've managed to make suitable for adults.
Mm.
And I think the Star Wars, that's why I get really annoyed with Star Wars fans who, online, you know, people are like, they've ruined my childhood.
Yeah.
You're like, well, that's your fault then, isn't it? You're the problem here.
If your childhood is such a delicate thing that it can be ruined after the fact.
Yeah, because Luke Skywalker's a bit of a cunt in this one.
I thought I had a great childhood, but actually... It's all ruined.
It's the risk you run as well when you're creating stuff and putting it out there. It's gonna, you know, I'm sure I'm gonna get shit on at some point about that stuff. You just gotta, And also, like when you make something as a fan of something, you know, you're still going to disappoint people.
Yeah, but that's what I think the self-centered nature of people thinking they have ownership over a thing that somebody else created.
Mm.
Like if you're a fan of it, you're a fan. You don't own shit, mate. They invented it. Back off, buddy. Yeah. That's what I want to say. Star Wars fans need to whiten their necks in.
So when people say things like it's owned by the fans, you know, I'm pretty sure that's not the legal position.
Not at all.
It's not owned by the fans at all. It's paid for by the fans, but it's not owned by the fans.
Yeah, I think it's good to keep a detachment from your things you love.
Mm.
You know what I mean? That's why, like, you know, you see Morrissey fans now getting upset because he's aged into a right-wing old lunatic. It's like, but that's, you know, and they're like, oh my god, it's ruined everything he ever done. It's like, what? No, but you liked him then. Just it's fine. They now just don't like him now.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to change.
Don't like him as a person. You can still enjoy the music.
Yeah, you can also change how you feel about things.
Take
it so personally.
People don't like changing is the problem.
That's it.
They don't like adapting, finding stuff. Because new stuff is coming out all the time as well. There's plenty more.
Yeah.
Don't go see Star Wars. Put that money into an independent find a new Star Wars.
Yeah.
Go and watch a Ghost Story.
That's not a new Star Wars. I didn't see any Millennium Falcon under that sheet.
What's your show called this year?
It's called Strictly Carl Donnelly, which is technically a pun, but I don't want people like. But it doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
So it's I thought I'd call it that for a laugh. So some people might go, is that meant to refer to Strictly Come Dancing?
And presumably it doesn't at all.
Well, no, it does. I thought it sounds almost like Strictly Come Dancing, but because it's not really a themed show as such, I thought it'd just be good to have a vague title.
It's
just about me.
If you ever find yourself talking about something that isn't you, you strictly take that bit out of the show.
A klaxon goes off. And return to topic. Also be just aware. A minute.
Also be aware, audience, the title may change to The Bucket.
Yeah. So where can listeners find you, Cole?
They can find me on social media and in real life. I'm on all them Twitter and all that as Carl Donnelly. And I'm just always knocking around, gigging.
And are your gigs listed on a website?
Yeah, they are. carldonnelly.co.uk. Just sort of up to date. And it's got details of two podcasts that I also do.
Cool.
One's called the Carl and Chris Podcast. And one is Babysitting Trevor. Which is, that's probably, you know, tune into that one, it's better. That's the way it works, isn't it? The other one at the minute is sort of on a hiatus because my podcast partner lives in LA now. So we're sort of doing them, alternating them, but Babysitting Trevor's more of a series type thing.
What is Babysitting Trevor?
It's where we've we basically have taken comedian Trevor Crook under our wing, and we've tried to make him into a modern man. Because he's amazing. Such an old, mad bastard.
Incredible.
So we do episode, series of six. We just released a third series, and we take him to things like yoga and stuff, but we try and make him join the modern age. Me and Chris Martin.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we've got a fourth series in the can that's going out soon. But it's just...
I said, was Chris the partner
that's
living
so
in
LA. He lives in LA.
But you've done these...
We recorded season three and season four before he went out in October. So yeah, it's just if you want to hear a mad Australian old bastard just get annoyed with us for trying to get him to do things.
Sounds awesome.
And yeah, and he writes poetry and erotic fiction for some reason. So it's really dumb, but really funny. Should we just let him sort of fill the time and make us laugh?
Yeah. I did Birmingham Glee once with him. He went off on one that he couldn't find anybody to give him a handy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was like a tirade.
Yeah.
He goes, come on, everybody wants a handy.
Yeah, he's got this ability to be really sweet and lovely and philosophical, but then be like the most disgusting, depraved man in the next sentence.
Cool. Listeners, check that out. Thanks very much, Carl.
Cheers, man.
Cheers. And don't edit the bit out where I call you a cunt.
Okay. What, that one or the one for?
I leave both cunts in, please.
Now we've got three.
Bye.